Hi, Oktak. Ora dubled med oss i Mapping the Zone, en podcast dedikert til en svart fixert anmeldelse av store tette boker, spesielt verkerne og konteksten til Thomas Pynchon. Jeg heter Cody. Jeg en av medverte.
Jeg heter Kate.
I'm Luke.
Jeg heter Will.
Jeg heter Johan.
For those non-Norwegian speaking listeners, hello and thank you for joining us on Mapping the Zone, a podcast dedicated to highly fixated reviews of large, dense books, specifically the works and context of Thomas Pynchon. This is our wrap-up episode on part one of Against the Day, and we are joined, as you can already tell, by Johan Harstad, the author of Red Handler and Buzz Aldrin, What Happened to You and All the Confusion, among many other books. Unfortunately, those two are really the only ones I have available as translation in English, but he has written several other books, and we were lucky enough to get in contact with him after the episode I did on the Red Handler, which was just mind-blowing to get that email, and we've been corresponding, and we're really happy to have him here. So, Johan, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
No, thank you. It's my pleasure. It's an honor.
So, as I said, this is our discussion on part one of Against the Day, The Light Over the Ranges. So we're going to spend this time, like we do with all of our other wrap-up episodes, just kind of talking about our thoughts on the book so far. And we'll pose some questions to Johan as far as what he's, you know, how he's been engaging with the book. And we'll kind of go over some of our favorite parts and just have a general kind of discussion on the book. So I'd like to start with you, Johan. Is this your first time reading this book?
It is, and I have to say how thankful I am, because I hadn't when the Red Handler podcast came out, I was in the middle of reading Mason and Dixon, about 170 pages in, and suddenly when you reached out and you were in the beginning of the Against the Day, I thought that okay, this is a great opportunity to actually tackle that behemoth of a book which had been standing there in the bookshelf as something almost like a climbable mountain or something, or something I sort of dreaded starting on. And I had also just kept finished Rebecca's Rainbow. Mm-hmm. The reason I really want to thank you is that I've had such I'm sort of struggling to find the correct words. Joy is sort of an understatement. I mean, what an extraordinary book this is. And I'm so thankful for being able to find that kind of literature at the age of 46. And reading something that makes you feel just like you did when you were 16, and finding something that you really, really love, and knowing that you're only in the beginning of it, it's just a tremendous feeling. So, as you can tell, I pretty much love this book, even though I've only read the first section so far.
Yeah, it's a phenomenal read. And I wish I could it's one of those ones that I do wish I could experience again for the first time, because I have a very visceral memory of the first time I read it, and specifically the first time I finished it. This was actually the second Pynchon book I ever read. I read Inherent Vice when the movie was coming out, just to be familiar with it. And that was my gateway into Pynchon's work. And then I remember sitting at my dining room table at, I think it was like 10:30, 11 o'clock at night, and finishing Against the Day and closing it. And I just walked into the other room where my wife was, and I was like, I think this might be the best thing I've ever read. And I couldn't really say any more about that. I was just so awestruck by the experience at that point. And that memory has just kind of lived with me. There's very few books that I've read that have impacted me in that particular way. And so I'm really excited that you're getting to experience this for the first time. And I definitely, when you finish it, I would love to hear your thoughts on it. So but we'll kind of jump from there. I do, real quick, before we get into the first part of the book, I do just want to kind of get your experience with Pynchon. How did you come into his work? How much of it have you read at this point? Do you have a favorite of his?
Well, to start with the beginning, I can actually pinpoint sort of the exact moment when I I discovered Thomas Pynchon, even though I had no idea that something I would later actually read. I have this very vivid memory. It has to be in 97, just when Mason and Dixon came out, of someone somewhere in Stavanger, the town where I'm from, sitting outside a store, reading Mason and Dixon. And when it came out, I remember it was, you know, it was all in the shops and everything. And for me, even though I was interested in literature, it wasn't something I didn't know about him. I just remember how the book looks and the name and Mason and Dixon. And I probably thought to myself that, this is just like a romantic novel from yesteryear or something like that. So just, I remember looking at the guy reading that book and thinking, he should read some good stuff instead of that romantic, which he's probably reading. And then a few years later, the book came out. Gyldendal, which is my Norwegian publisher. And then I understood, oh shit, it's important. And then years goes by, and I have this friend of mine who's is half Norwegian, half American. And he was the one who really turned me into Thomas Pynchon, having pretty much read everything, I think. And for many years, we kept talking about him, and I had all these false starts, trying to read Crying of Lord 49, trying to read V, trying to read this and that, and I just, for some reason, I couldn't get into it. And so instead, I found David Foster Wallace, which became extremely important to me. And he also came into my life pretty late. I mean, I remember buying Infinite Jest at around 99 or 2000 or something. But again, it was just sitting there on my shelf without being opened. So I was probably in my early 30s when I started reading David Foster Wallace. And I remember that feeling you mentioned with Against the Day and finishing that was the same feeling I had when I finished Infinite Jest. That sort of perfect scene at the end with Gately and, you know, the tide being real low and everything. Yeah. So I read everything by David Foster Wallace, except for his debut. And again, I think through him and my, how should I say it, sort of through my interest for David Foster Wallace and that suspicion that Pynchon had been more important to Wallace than he admitted, I felt the need to go and have a look. And again, since I'm one of my aforementioned best friend, was also this Pynchon sort of expert. I felt I had to read it. And then as you mentioned, then the movie came along, Inherent Vice. And that, I think, became my entry point. Sort of simultaneously, already in the span of a few days, reading Inherent Vice and watching the movie. And that really opened it up for me. And since then, I've only really read Gravity's Rainbow, which maybe you can't even say just, I mean, it's sort of an uphill struggle to read that novel. As I mentioned earlier, I'm like 170 pages into Mason Dixon until you people turned up.
So I know Kate is kind of the big Wallace fan here. I'm reading Infinite Jest for the first time, and it's been a real pleasure. I started it last year, and I just couldn't get in the right headspace for it. Put it down and came back to it a few months ago, maybe early December, and it's been a phenomenal read so far. I'm about a little over halfway through, and it's just been a real pleasure to read, and I'm really excited to finish that one up and kind of dive more into his work. But You mentioned, since you brought up Mason and Dixon, you mentioned in one of our earlier emails that there was some sort of, I guess, drama with the translation of that particular book in Norway. Is that right?
No, it's a translation of Against the Day.
Oh, against the day. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. How should I say it? In a review of the book in the weekly newspaper Morgenbladet, which is sort of like the morning news or something, Morning Gazette, which is sort of a heavyweight paper when it comes to culture, politics, and the likes. And the reviewer, who's also kind of, like a fringe author or something, by the name of Herman Willis, he praised the book, but totally obliterated the Norwegian translation, calling it absolutely rubbish. And the problem was that quite a few of the examples he gave couldn't be found in the Norwegian translation at all. It seemed to stem from errors made in several US reviews of the book, which then made the reviewer and later also the leader of the Norwegian Translation Society retaliate with questioning whether or not the reviewer had actually read the translation at all.
Oh, wow.
I don't know if you want to, you will indulge me. I can read something to you from the, how do you say it, like a piece the translator wrote in the same newspaper a couple of weeks later, trying to sort of defend himself. Yeah, and so you can just edit it out. It's too long. Okay. So the name of the translator is Farten Dövle Jonasson. Yeah, he says. Thomas Pynchon's masterpiece Against the Day is an unsolved mystery, wild, funny, strange, and impenetrable. I've spent part of my life translating it into Norwegian. So it was with great excitement that I found the review in Morgenbladet and started reading. A pat on the back and a kind word be in order. The reviewer is well acquainted with his peculiar author. He speaks with casual certainty about his writing and compares him to Bob Dylan. Both are clearly a bit of a hero for the reviewer. And he has enjoyed the book, it turns out. He has taken advantage of the bad skiing conditions this Easter and curled up for a fantastic journey. I am impressed. Even experienced readers struggle to get through this book in less than a month. He continues to praise the book in high tones and expound on what wisdom and insight he finds in the text. He seems so easygoing, this reviewer, learned and well-read, yet fresh in his style, and he speaks with authority about big and difficult questions. And it comes. The only thing that is good, that is not good about this book, is the translation. It must have been done on bad drugs. It is a crime that should have been reported to the literary police. It is weak, sloppy, narrow-minded, and highbrow, and does not at all resemble the really folksy language artist Pynchon. He continues to list a number of mistakes that have irritated him along the way. And I collapse in shock. Can this be true? Has my translation really made the reviewer so furious? I go through the list of alleged mistakes and discuss them with colleagues. The mistakes boil down to disagreements about equivalent word choices, an anglicism, and some rather strange misreadings on the reviewer's part. Let me illustrate. This is the Barbary Coast, Norwegian Barbarischisten, is wrong, the reviewer says, and tells us that it was once called the Berber Coast, and it's named after the Berbers who lived along the Mediterranean. Look it up. Well, embarrassingly incorrect one would then have been Barbarischisten. But the novel's Barbary Coast cannot be this coast, since the action here takes place in the US of A, the mountains of Colorado, and it's clear from the sentence that one can travel there by train. Mysterious. Why does the reviewer's thoughts wander to the Berbers and the Mediterranean, when what he's reading takes place on another continent, and blah, 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 and it just goes on and on, and he sort of goes through all the objections the reviewer had and sort of obliterates them back. And after that, things became rather murky. The reviewer said this about the attack on his attack. So the reviewer reacts like this. I'll say like Michael Corleone in The Godfather, a true enemy has yet to reveal himself. This is about something else, but what I cannot say. I have my own thoughts, but I think it's best that I keep them to myself. And Since then, the reviewer has never given any further explanations to his quoting the sources, nor defended his criticism of specific words chosen by the translator. And it should be noted that this is not the first time the author slash reviewer has accused translators for sloppy work, not the first time, as I want to be enfant terrible, has received criticism for his confrontational and outright falsely accusatory stance. He no longer reviews books, and I don't know if he reviews anything anymore. So, yeah.
That is wild.
Yeah, what I really think it has to do is, you know that some that thing when you're really, really, maybe when we were younger at least, when you were a big fan of something and someone else came along, also a fan of this or that, and you had this urge to prove that you are an even bigger fan or you know more about this or something,
mm-hmm.
Sort of like, you know, mine is bigger than yours thing. I think it's a little bit like that. It's sort of embarrassing because he cannot have read the Norwegian translation. Because here's the thing. This is sort of the most useless fun fact you'll ever hear. There's one error in the Norwegian translation that it goes on and on. Whenever in Against the Day, the Norwegian translation, which is called Mot Dagen, whenever there's an ellipsis, you know, the dot, dot, dot,
mm-hmm.
The last letter prior to the ellipsis is for some reason gone. There's all these letters missing. So apparently not even the proofreader had the stomach to read the book.
Oh my gosh.
That's shocking.
And I don't think he mentions that.
That's wild. Well, to move into the book itself, I kind of want to go around and we'll start with you, Johan. How do you feel about this first part so far? This being your first time, I know you mentioned earlier that you've been really impressed by it so far. Is there anything in particular that you're taking away from it that's really standing out, or is it just kind of overall the whole thing? I just kind of want to get your feelings on the story so far.
It's a little bit of both. Obviously it's the sum of all the parts and all the moving parts, I should say, because there's so many of them. But what I really liked was, through the first two chapters, when you really start to get into the chumps of chance, I have this feeling that I really want to stay with them longer. So I'm sort of heading the next chapter where we'll probably head into something different. And I had the experience over this first section that whenever we went into something, when the story focused to another character, that I more or less fell even more in love with the next character. So going from the chumps of chance, and then, oh, there's Basnight and all his stuff, and, you know, he's taking the very elaborate elevator and going to the White City investigation costume / disguise department, and then suddenly we're in when the Merle Rideout story starts and have this Western story starting, and by the way, I love this section with the ball lightning. You talked about it in one of the other episodes, but I just felt that someone I just really, really liked it, because when I was a kid, for reasons completely known to me, this was something we were warned about as children.
Oh, really?
Yeah, beware of the ball lightning. Like, it was something that you could, you know, happened almost every time it was a lightning storm. And we were really scared to stay close to windows and everything. We sort of hid under the covers whenever there was a lightning storm. And the fact that this ball of lightning starts up a conversation is, I really, really like it. And now again, so it just keeps on going, and then into the web traverse story, and the story of him and Maiva. talking about whether or not she was a saloon girl, and you know.
I'm not sure that I'm really answering the question, but I think on a more overall level, this is why I really fell for the writing of Ancient, because it's almost every page, or at least in every chapter, there are these truly, truly like gems of literature, whether it is a really, really heartfelt story about being a parent, or this last night having this, and I'm not sure if you talked about it in the first episode. There's a section very early on when he's on a tram, I think, and he just gives this wonderful summary of everyone in the car with him.
Mm-hmm.
Just come in and save me whenever you want from this rambling. or maybe before you do that, let me also say this, because I'm reading this book and you know, all literature I read it as in two ways. I read it as a reader, and mm-hmm. I read it as a writer, since I'm an author myself. And when I'm over the fact that this is extremely dense in a very positive way, literature, and in many ways overwhelming, I think the single word I'm left with, and this is not just Against the Day, but also Gravity's Rainbow or even Inherent Vice, is the word freedom. And by that I mean the freedom, the absolute freedom, for me and for Pynchon as a writer to do whatever he needs to do, to write it just in that way he wants to, without letting the manuscript go through a focus group or anything. It leaves me with that feeling that, as they say with the movies, they just don't make him like that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I really, really respect that way of writing without any boundaries.
Yeah, he definitely, you know, like Kate and I talked about David Lynch on the bonus episode we just did about him, like that isn't, Pynchon is another artist who really has kind of allowed himself to make the story that he wants to make, and doesn't allow himself to really compromise on where he stands and on how he wants to present his story. So you're spot on with that. Kate, Will, Luke, what are y'all's thoughts on the book so far? I know Kate, you're the other one who this is the first time for you.
So that's true.
I'm curious to hear what you think so far.
I as much of like a Herculean task as reading Gravity's Rainbow is, I've always kind of disagreed with the perception of that book that like every sentence in it is a research project, which I believe is the exact headline of Leaf by Leaf's video about it on YouTube.
I think so, yeah.
There are certainly sections of the book where that is true, but overall there is enough of a strung together narrative in that novel that even if you're not researching every single connection, you can still sort of understand the points that he's going for. I think that sort of designation belongs more to this book. I don't know if I've done as much research for any of the previous three seasons we've done as I have in what is it, four episodes that we've recorded for this
something
already?
Like that,
we're splitting one of them in two, obviously, because it's too long. But just from a conceptual perspective, there is so much information going on here that I actually think does significantly benefit from researching. Like the decision to refer to the the unionists as anarchists is true for the time frame as far as their opposition goes, but it doesn't necessarily give the reader the greatest understanding of who these people are if they're not doing some additional research themselves. So from a perspective of just like the sheer density of information line by line, chapter by chapter, it's got to be the highest so far, at least, of any of his books for me anyway. I think that it is also benefited from the fact that this is later in his career. There are certain elements of his early career novels, like the more difficult to understand prose, and the kind of characters as representations of themes that don't carry as much sort of weight with them, that we've talked about a lot over the course of the show so far, that is really fixed in his books post Gravity's Rainbow. And I think that a lot of the stuff that he's trying to do, and if I was to pick sort of a moment of distillation relating the crash of the or the panic of 1892-1893 to the death of innocence in a child at the former World's Fair sort of site in Chicago, I think is a perfect distillation of at least what it seems he's doing over the first chunk of this novel, which is relating these broad scale movements of capitalism and modernity down to the effect it has on the individual person, is what it mm-hmm. seems like he's doing a lot of. And that is going to only be as successful as your readers are interested in the characters that you've presented to them to be invested in. And I don't know if he would have been as successful doing that if this book was published earlier in his career, with the sort of lack of growth in his character writing at that point. So it's especially wonderful that it came out at the time that it did, because he succeeds completely in my mind in what has been one of the major kind of overarching themes of the first chunk of the book, because you do, you know, you do feel for Webb and his family when that whole thing falls apart as a result of circumstances out of their control. You do feel for Merle Rideout when he's relaying what happened to, you know, his wife and him and his family, and how that leads him to be isolated to the point where he's willingly going to go do amalgamation work that's probably going to rot his brain. You know, you have the space to care about and to become emotional about these characters, and it is a remarkably approachable in how it's written too. Like, this book is not difficult, at least to me, and it could just be that we've been continuously reading Pynchon for 2 years now, and I've lost clarity on kind of picking up his books and going and reading other stuff. But to me, it's a highly readable book for the material that he's covering. And that's always, of course, been one of the biggest kind of criticisms of his writing, for better or worse. But there's been very few moments in this book where I've struggled to understand what he's saying or struggled to follow what it is that he's writing. So it's been a great experience so far. And if it continues in the way that it has been for just this first section, as far as its quality, as far as its thematic intent and its thematic sort of delivery, you know, it could become my favorite Pynchon book. I'm not going to say that it's not going to be, or that it is going to be, but I'm really excited and am properly enthused for a project that's going to take as long as this one is going to.
Luke, Will, what are y'all's thoughts so far?
My general thoughts on this section can really be, I guess, distilled down to an analogy that no one other than Kate and Cody have heard as of yet, because we get to it in the second half episode that has yet to come out. this is like the peak of like building narrative tension, and that's really curious, because reading through this section, whether from start to finish or section by section as we record the episodes, there's very little actual like narrative tension going on. But in terms of the sense of precipitousness, I guess, the sense that everything is lining up, you get a sense, and I think a lot of this has to do with that element of the researchability and the detailed understanding of the historical context that Kate mentioned. There's so much about this time in history that, at least in the European sphere, the European and North American sphere, but, you know, going through Central and South America and China and Japan, that covers my knowledge. I don't know enough about the rest of the world to say confidently, but it feels like Pynchon's done such a good job of aligning all these things so that it's clear that everything is waiting for change. Everything is demanding motion. Everything is demanding the release of some kind of barely restrained momentum, I guess, in the political, in the scientific, in the economic, in the just purely baseline social spheres. And so much of that is coming to a head right as the end of part one comes around. And I love the sense of altitude that you get from the Chumps of Chance as much as I love all of the little details about Dally just coming of age right around then, of Kit beginning to fall in love with science, of Merle falling in love with photography and alchemy. And you get this I'm not going to say false sense, because that would be too foreshadowing, obviously. You get this real sense of release, that there's going to be another shoe that drops, just through the sheer lack of conflict in the story so far. And it's a beautiful way in the macro scale of the whole thousand some pages of the book to get the reader invested, because sure, more characters are going to be introduced, plenty more, but you get this wonderful alignment of these thematic intentions behind each character with enough of that baseline narrative and humorous level that Pynchon works so well with, to just fall in love with them and want to see where their lives go from here on.
Yeah, to kind of piggyback off that, I think that's one of my favorite parts about this first section is seeing these individual characters kind of discover their passions and how they come into them and how they start to shape their lives at this part of the book. And it really gives such an extra layer of humanity, character depth to these characters that really, I think, helps endear the reader to them, which then, like Kate mentioned earlier, is part of what really helps make this book what it is and accomplish what it's trying to accomplish. And it makes it really hard. I want to ask later, I want to hear Luke's thoughts on the chapters or on the section so far, but I also want to talk about these characters after that as well, because I think that there's not just so many of them, but there are so many of them who are this early into the book so endearing and so lovable as characters that it's rare to find in a book of this size, especially, and to have those characters have that much importance so early on in the story. But before we get to that, I want to give Luke an opportunity to talk about his feelings on this first section of the book.
As I kind of go over every 2 weeks, every week on the show, I do really like this first section. Some highlights for me are, you know, the ending of the section. We move away from America with the Chumps of Chance going to the Pacific Ocean and islands of the Pacific Ocean. And that does kind of foreshadow the fact that the rest of the book gets a bit more international, which is one of my favorite aspects of this book, is how much ground it covers over the course of the 1,000+ pages. So I like that. You know, the character work in the first section is great. You know, Merle's kind of a standout to me. I do wish we got more of Lupe Aznite. But yeah, and to kind of piggyback off something that Kate said with the loss of innocence and the economic downturn in 1892 and 1893, I do remember, I think it was in 2008, 2009, I was in college and we were discussing, me and some of my friends, because I hung out with a lot of business majors in college for reasons that I can't quite pin down 15 years later, but I did. And we were talking about the, you know, like all of the, like the bailouts from 2007, I believe, and kind of the economic situation in America. And I was personally expressing confusion as to why the American government bailed out the banking system. And this guy that would go on to be probably my best friend in college, who I'm still in contact with, talked about how in 1892 and 1893, the American government was bailed out by JP Morgan Chase, by like private investors. So I believe the American government went bankrupt around that time due to, I did do some research into this, but I'm kind of blanking on exactly why. It had something to do with like silver, I want to say. Anyways, but so my friend framed the U.S. government bailing out JP Morgan Chase, the bank, and the other banks as kind of repayment for the banks bailing the U.S. government out over 100 years earlier. And I do remember it striking me as pretty ridiculous that you know, that could be viewed as a reason that 100 plus years later, we have to repay that debt. And I do think that's especially relevant and kind of cool considering that the Against the Day starts with the word now. And as we've kind of been over some, there do seem to be sections of the first section that seem to kind of be commentaries or a commentary on the world in the early 2000s, mid-2000s. And, you know, that aspect that Kate kind of points out is maybe a bit prophetic in terms of kind of foreshadowing the what would go on about a year and 2 years after the book was published. Yeah, I don't. I mean, the first section, I wasn't able to record the last few weeks, so I'll go into a little bit of my, you know, like, so parts of this are set in Colorado Springs. I went to high school in Colorado Springs, lived in Colorado Springs for about 3 years in my 20s. Also lived in Denver some in my 20s, and I have a lot of personal connections to Colorado Springs. You know, like the Pitchin mentions the Colorado Springs School for the Deaf and Blind. It's kind of a throwaway line. It's not a major, obviously not a major aspect of the first section or that chapter. But I used to play that school in football and basketball in high school, which is, you know, very odd for me, at least, to read something like that personal, something I have such a personal connection to in a Pynchon novel. I remember we had a reader write in about their personal connections to Vineland, and I remember being kind of jealous and stuff of their personal connections and kind of, you know, being able to see themselves in a Pynchon novel. So that experience was a bit surreal to read. And yeah, I mean, this isn't super important, but Pikes Peak is a major aspect of living in Colorado Springs. You know, I have an almost infinite amount of memories of seeing the sunset over Pikes Peak, and or, like, you know, turning a corner while I'm driving and having a great view of Pikes Peak all of a sudden in some area of town I had never been to before. So all the stuff about Tesla and Colorado Springs, I really loved. All that being said, you know, I do really love the first section. I don't think it's my favorite section in the book. It's been a few years, probably about 10 years since I've read this book, so I don't have a super great grasp on what comes next, what comes after this. I obviously don't want to do any spoilers, but there are, I do remember some of my favorite prose sections, I think, come later in the book. I want to say in the third section. There's some just really cool stuff coming up in the rest of the book that I'm very excited about. Where, like, the first section is kind of, it has some, like, kind of prologue aspects of it where, like, you know, especially the split between Kit and his dad, Webb, is a surprisingly major driving point for a lot of what's to come. Because we end up, you know, this is a bit of a spoiler, but we end up following Kit as he journeys through life for a while. That's a good chunk of the book is Kit and characters that are connected to Kit. Yeah, so, you know, I do love this first section, but I love that it sets up the greatness that's yet to come, that we're yet to read.
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely agree there. So as I mentioned a couple minutes ago, I want to talk about the characters that we've met so far. This isn't everyone that we will meet along the way, but it's a lot of them. And I'll start with you again, Johan. Do you have a favorite character amongst the ones that we've been introduced to so far? Or I'll say myself, it's really hard for me to pin down one. It kind of shifts every time I read it. But I am particularly endeared to the Chums of Chance. And I know you mentioned you were as well. And I like hearing that because there tends to be a sort of, I don't want to say backlash, but they aren't as well received by a lot of the people I've seen in the community. Which is kind of disheartening, but I do love them so. But I'm curious if you have if they're your favorite, or if there's another character so far that you're kind of endeared to more.
Well, I'm not sure if they're really my favorites as of yet, but I'm feeling that could change. I mean, I'm really intrigued by them, but I feel that to some degree that I still I'm still waiting to sort of separate them from each other a little bit, trying mm-hmm. to, you know, remember, okay, who's this guy and who's this, and then, you know, what are their different roles aboard the Inconvenience, etc. Though I do love the dog, whatever
you call it. Pugnax, yes.
Yeah. And that was strange because You know, fairly early on in Mason Dixon, there's also the very clever dog, the talking dog, whose name escapes me. But so I do like the idea of a clever dog, and I don't have it in front of me now, but there's a wonderful section where I sum up Pugnacs likes to eat. It has to be like China, this and this kind. It has to be like champagne and everything. But I do like the whole tone of so far at least of Jumps of Chance. This whole dime novel voice adventure style, and like everything is going to be sort of everything's groovy, and then you do get the sense at the end of the first section that this is about to change when they get these strange orders in the Mr. Pearl. But maybe their happiest days are behind them. I don't know. I think maybe Merle Rideout is my favorite at this point, and it probably has to do with I really, really love those section where he talks about how do you pronounce it? Earlys? Earls?
Yeah, Earlys. I think that would be my best guess for it.
Yeah. And sort of that really sad reflection is having and about the loss of her and daughter and going to that store where he finds interview the piece on all the names are escaping me now.
On the Great Zambini?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's sort of get that sense of him really understanding that she has a completely different life, and his life has been standstill when she has just continued. But I'm also really, really intrigued by the whole Kit thing and the meeting. Mm-hmm. Scarsdale vibe and Paul the Walker and yeah. But this is the thing again, what I mentioned earlier, that it's just so many, and I don't remember who of you used the word lovable, but there's so many lovable characters early on. And this also connects to something which Kate mentioned, which I also want to just agree with, that the accessibility of this novel really surprised me. It's not that it's a simple read, you know, you can't read it while you're, you know, doing the dishes or something like that. Yeah. But compared to, say, Gravity's Rainbow, which for me at least seems to have a much more cut up style, I found that much harder to sort of keep control of. I had to really concentrate in a different way when I read Gravity's Rainbow, constantly trying to figure out where are we and who are these people and who's talking. And again, some of you mentioned it already, but I also think it has to do with age. I think it has to do with experience on Pynchon's part. You know, he's written all these books that are sort of mic drop difficult and almost impenetrable. And then when Against the Day comes, it's time to, I don't know, sort of broaden it out in a sense, trying to at the same time be extremely dense and extremely complicated and full of meaning and subtext and all these things. But it's also like really just unfolding storytelling in a way. And I think, I'm not sure if I would suggest that anyone who hasn't read Pynchon starts with Against the Dead. That could be, you know, a little bit too.
It's a big ask, yeah.
A lot, yeah.
Yeah. But it's something. I felt the first section of Against the Dead is similar in a way to reading Inherent Vice, in that it isn't difficult to understand what's going on and the details. You can sort of enjoy all the details instead of spending too much time figuring out where, what, and who, and why.
and that would appreciate it.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think that it can be, it can seem, I don't want to say off-putting, but it can be viewed as a challenge to start this book as your first pinch on, just due to the sheer size of it. I can get that might be an intimidating thing to look at. It is literally a doorstopper of a book. But yeah, it's, you know, exactly like you said, that these characters are so well done, and the accessibility that exists, like Kate said, it really lends to making this I don't want to say an easy reading experience, because it's not something that you can, like you said, Johanna, you can't just, you know, have this sort of as a peripheral thing that you're focusing on while you're doing something else, or that you're just kind of using as a light read. It's definitely not that. I mean, I guess you could read it in that way, but you wouldn't really take a lot away from it. It is a book that demands your attention, but not in an aggressively challenging way. It's more of, it's offering you this really interesting and very unique experience as a novel, but you just have to be willing to commit to it and get on its level to be able to really appreciate it as such. I think that something like Gravity's Rainbow is a more challenging read. Yeah, like in the sense that it is easier to get lost, like you said. I find myself doing that as well, and I've read it a few times, and there are still sections where I have to stop myself and kind of backtrack and catch up to, you know, who's talking in this scene, or what part of the world are we in, or you know, what other characters, what led to this, where we are now. But, and it's not anything against it as how it's written. I think it's kind of intentionally done that way, to where it's supposed to sort of be disorienting and jarring and displacing. So for a novel like this to be longer than that, but to still present as much information and to still have as much complexity as it does while remaining easily accessible is a really hard thing to do, I would imagine, as a writer, and something that Pynchon is just making look really easy. So it's a kind of a tip of the hat thing for him to be able to do that. But I completely agree. But I want to open the floor to everyone else. As far as characters that we've met so far, does anyone else have any particular favorites?
I think probably the whole chapter with Merle Rideout still stands as my favorite. I think that, and really what a lot of that comes down to is that sequence in which he discovers photography, so to speak.
I love that so much.
And then like the inherent magic in it. Like that's just so great in a lot of different ways that we obviously talked about at the time. So that's a character that really, I love a lot, especially with, you know, his overarching desire to, like, really take care of his kid as best he can, despite his wife having run off with, you know, another man. And despite what is essentially a betrayal as far as what happened with his wife, he doesn't speak ill of her. He doesn't, you know, he doesn't reframe their relationship as her being a horrible woman to his daughter. He just honestly takes a position of, well, I don't know when she's coming back, if she's ever coming back. She said she would, but he's just going to leave that up to his daughter. He is, despite the way that he's introduced and like the way that you can interpret his character at the beginning, just very clearly doing his best.
Yeah.
And it's a really attractive character trait to me from a perspective of how it is that he's gone about his life and how it is that he's continuing to take care of his daughter, and the way that Pynchon writes about his passion for photography and how that eventually sort of turns over into this, are they talking about real magic? Are they not? That whole conversation that's very clearly in a series of coded messages between him and Webb, is great. And then, you know, I would say Webb Travers would be the other one. Those two primary characters really stick out to me as my favorite too. Not just because we get the most amount of detail out of them, but also the kind of, from a compositional element, the kind of handoff that you get from one character to the other to look at the same sort of history from two different sides is really, really elegantly done by Pynchon as far as a specific like writing and construction of the novel. But also just, again, those different, like, very real familial elements about it that we talked about in those episodes that I don't believe have been released yet, or maybe one has. It's great. That's really a pair of twin characters in a lot of ways that I think are excellent. They have similar family issues, you know, similar fears about their children leaving and turning into other people they don't recognize, but for different reasons. It's another example of duality in a lot of ways in this book between those characters that I love. Those two would be the standouts for me. The Chums of Chance are fun. They are deliberately underwritten because they are literary examples of a genre that doesn't need characterization to succeed. And yeah, their stuff is just, it's fun. It's fun, silly stuff that can distract you from sort of the horrors of anti-unionist activity and the expansion of capitalism to you know, resource extract from the global south, which makes up a lot of the background elements of the other chapters in this book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, for me, it's kind of a tricky thing to choose a favorite character at this point in the book, if only because so much of the later developments really is where I in my previous time reading this book came to love a lot of them. So I'm gonna have to split it in a couple different ways, because like when it comes to who I am most engaged with on an emotional level in this section of the book so far, I really do relate to Kit Traverse's kind of deep spiritual engagement with scientific and mathematical thinking. I find that very easy to relate to, and so in that "hey, is me" kind of way, I do really love his character and where he goes, even as things develop. And kind of a flip side, Dally, I by the end of the book is my clear favorite character. Mm-hmm. And at this point, you only really get the very beginnings of who she is as a person within the book. But even at this point, she is as worldly as a child of that time who is treated as seriously as Merle treats her would be. And so she is just so at this point heartfelt and so engaged with everything going on around her, and that's just a delightful kind of character as device that Pynchon's playing with. But then on the more like intellectual level, like Foley Walker is a fascinating character.
Oh yeah.
And I in this section we get like two lines with him and then a couple of pages, and he is just so fascinating to think about as a counterpart to Scarsdale Vibe, to think about as an opposition to Webb in some ways, to think mm-hmm. of him as like a distillation of like the movements of the Chums of Chance, despite the both of their kinds of lacks of awareness of one another. And I just love those three characters as they are in the chapter, but as the book goes on, so much more.
I think I already mentioned that Lou Bastnight is probably my favorite character in this book, and I do really love Lou Bastnight. I kind of forgot that he disappears for a while here in the first section. Thought I remember that he was a bigger character in this first section. That being said, I mean, kind of looking back on the first section, you know, Merle is obviously a standout. I really like, as y'all have kind of been over, you know, the fact that he doesn't villainize his ex-girlfriend, ex-wife to Dally. I think it would have been really easy for Pynchon to kind of insert that in there, even like maybe sarcasm or some humor related to it. You know, Pynchon doesn't go that way. I do think that that kind of helps endear him to the reader. I like the Chums of Chance probably more than most people. I actually didn't realize that they were somewhat controversial in the Pynchon fandom. They're kind of endearingly annoying or something. Like, you know, I like them.
That's a good way to put it, yeah.
Yeah, like I like them, but I think if I were to hang out with them, I'd get tired of them. I think it's the best way to put that. But there'd be a lot of novelty to it and stuff, but it would get old, I think, hanging out with a bunch of teenagers.
No, that's a good point. I think that they're fun to have on the page and to have them in small doses, but I think, yeah, if I had to spend any amount of time with them in real life, it would probably be pretty rough to get through, and I'd want to probably just throw myself off the ship as well.
Let me ask you a question, because you seem to be doing a tremendous amount of research for this, but I wanted to ask about section where Franz Ferdinand shows up, the Archduke. He seems to be really painted as a, how should I say it? It's great fun to read about him, but because he comes like a complete asshole. do any of you have any, you know, I really don't know much about him as a person. I'm, you know, my only relation to him is knowing his importance after the First World War in Sarajevo, etc. But as a person, is it a sort of a correct way to describe him? Was he like that, or is it? Yeah, you know what I mean.
Yeah, from what I've read of, and I'm not by any means any kind of an expert on the history of Archduke Franz Ferdinand, but I don't think he was that way in real life. I think what makes it work is that he seems to be a lot more on the opposite side of that, and that he was very conservative and sort of serious character in real life. And so having him displayed as this like almost anarchistic jokester who, you know, goes into bars and just starts getting into Yo Mama joke contests with people, and then almost getting himself beat up, and then declaring everyone gets free drinks before he just bails out and runs away.
It says when everyone when Franz Ferdinand drinks, everyone drinks or something, and when Franz Ferdinand pays, everyone pays.
Everyone pays. Yeah, it's one of my favorite scenes in this first part of the book. I absolutely love that part.
Yeah, I'm also far from an expert. I have an understanding that when he was a young man, prior to really any authority in his life, he had a reputation as a playboy, but I haven't done digging into how well-founded that was, whether it was just like a rumors based on like whatever kind of personal relationships he'd been having, and, you know, the rumor mills blowing that into, you know, sensationalized stories. But really, really no understanding. And I always took that portrayal of him as very much in the same way I read the introduction of the Chums of Chance as caricatures beyond caricature. I see him as very much a way to signal to readers who are not familiar with Pynchon's approach to history and seriousness in fiction, as kind of a way to say, hey, these people are not necessarily realistic, these historical events in this book, as he talked about in the press release announcing the book. This is not Franz Ferdinand, the historical figure. This is a character who I am building off of his real personhood. And that, you know, it's fun in that lens.
From the research that I did, it's obviously pretty hard to like come across, you know, like, well, what was Franz Ferdinand like in a drinking contest or something like that? But there is enough sort of strange elements of his life that it can paint a picture that he was probably at the very least a mess. He had like an addiction to hunting in one particular element, or one particular like hunting day that he went on. He shot apparently 2,170 animals. Jesus. On this privately controlled forest preserve, and over the course of his life, he is estimated to have like killed over 300,000 animals as a result of the hunting expeditions he would go on. And obviously that does come across when he brings up how fun it might be to hunt the Hungarians, the human people in the bar. He does make a mention of that during his appearance, and he did hate Hungarians in real life, certainly. Like, that was something that, for whatever reason, I'm sure that he had some kind of bullshit justification for it, but for someone who was a heartbeat away from being the Emperor of Austria-Hungary, he hated Hungarians with a passion. He also, like, begged his dad to let him marry out of royalty. He fell in love with this Czechoslovakian woman that he was allowed to marry, but was considered like very controversial, very strange, given that he is of the Habsburg line, leading to his sort of royalty. So he made a lot of weird decisions in that regard, and then he was a big like military guy. His job that kind of led him to become close to power when his dad was still in control of the empire was by reconsolidating the military basically under his own rule, because the Empire of Austria-Hungary at the time had a very big issue with more or less cliquiness. Like they would certain units would fight with one another, certain units wouldn't serve alongside other units because they had some, you know, like personal grudge or beef, and it was just very disorganized, and he kind of reordered that. And then, yeah, he did have a series of reforms that he wanted to set out that were very unpopular. He's very conservative, wanted to push more towards like a ruling middle class through industrialization. He was all over the map. So I think that when you look at the fact that he seemed to have kind of an uncontrolled personality and had been brought up not only in a royal bloodline, but had an intention to rock the boat when he eventually got in power, I don't think it's too hard to sort of extrapolate out from that he was maybe a little crazy if you were dealing with him in one-on-one, or that he liked to maybe drink to excess or go a little nuts. I think anyone who's killing 2,000 animals a day and finds that not satisfying probably has some kind of either adrenaline addiction or is just suffering from affluenza in some way.
That kind of leads to where I was going to want to go next, which is getting everyone's favorite part of the story so far. Is there a particular scene or a particular section that you found yourself really drawn to or that really stuck with you more than any others?
That's a good question. I mean, I already mentioned the scene where he discovers photography. That is certainly a stand.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, I mean, the pool hall scene with the balls that explode is also really up there. And that whole sequence from leaving the shootout at the pool hall to then stumbling into a priest leaving a brothel who gives that character just a real like BS kind of religious talk thing that he takes it desperately seriously because he's in the right state of mind for it. That whole sequence is really funny to me. I also do, this is less of a like specific scene or favorite moment, but I do like the kind of air of like evil that hangs above the Chums of Chance, not in the sense that they act evil or anything like that, but that for some reason they have a proximity to a lot of events that are not good or that are related to more evil things going on in the world. I think that that's a very effective device in their chapters, where like you know that they're feeding back into a system of some kind, but they don't have any connection to what that is, but that it is inherently sinister in a way. I find all of that very effective from Pynchon, and it adds like this kind of seedy undercurrent to chapters that are by and large very breezy in their dialogue and in their depiction of the characters that I think gives them an extra dimension that I appreciate.
And can I add to that with saying that I also really like with the Chums of Chance all these mentionings of other books sort of in the series.
Yeah.
It gives you a feeling that there's a lot of stuff that has happened that you probably should have known about or are expected to know about, but of course can't know about. And in just even the titles, like the references to, what is it, the Chums of Chance and the Evil Half-Wit, which I really like. Uh-huh. And also the one which more or less foreshadows, I think, inherent-wise. And maybe you mentioned that in another episode, the Chums of Chance and the Wrath of the Yellow Fang.
Yeah.
Which, of course, is close to the Golden Fang. And I also really, really like, and that is on the second of the section when they've gone through the opening, so to say, and they have this... maybe I can I just read it? Is
Yeah, absolutely.
And then just cut it away. So to set it up, they've gone through the portal or the opening in Antarctica, going into the hollow earth with inconvenience. And a fateful decision to land would immediately embroil them in the Byzantine politics of the region. Eventually, they would find themselves creeping perilously close to outright violation of the directives relating to non-interference and height discrepancy, which might easily have brought an official hearing and perhaps even disfellowship men from the national organization. For a detailed account of their subsequent narrow escapes from the increasingly deranged attentions of the legions of gnomes, unconscionable economics of a certain international mining cartel, essential wickedness pervading the royal courts of Ctonia, princes of Plutonia, and the all but irresistible fascination the subterranean monarch would come to exert, circular, upon the minds of the crew of Inconvenience, Miles, as we have seen in particular. Readers are referred to the chums of chance in the bowels of the earth. For some reason, one of the less appealing of this series, letters having come in from as far away as Tunbridge Wells, England, expressing displeasure, often quite intense, with my harmless little intra-terrestrial scherzo. I really just love that sequence.
I love that, yeah.
Sort of apologize for this writing. Should probably have gotten my reading glasses before I tried to read it, but yeah. You got it.
Yeah, that's a great, I love that little interaction. And yeah, we talked about that in the chapter 10 episode. That one hasn't come out yet because that was where we got too long in chapters 9 and 10 and need to cut it in half. So, but yeah, that is, I love that. And I love, as much as I love all of those sort of fake adventure novels that they have, I think that one might be my favorite just because, like you said, is sort of like apology for, I'm sorry if this isn't the best one I did, but you know, it's still worth reading.
Yeah, they're all good. In their own way, fully. Yeah.
Well, Luke, do you have a favorite section that you want to talk about, favorite part?
The section for me, I think I just come back to remembering the most when we, you know, prior to starting covering the book, was the section where Merle and Dally are just kind of going across the middle of America. And I just find that such an enchanting mix of very, very, like, you can dig into the sentences if you want. There's a ton of like implications going on, but there's also just a beautiful poetry and, you know, scenery and depictions of just kind of the way that life moves when you're not trying to make it make sense, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And I always come back to like the schools of land fishes kind of raising. Lovely, lovely stuff.
Absolutely is.
Yeah, my favorite part is probably specifically the description of the hotel that Lou Bassnight goes to when he's destitute in Chicago.
That is a great moment.
Yeah, just the description of the physical layout of the hotel is really fun and cool to think about. It's very kind of oneric and just fun to read.
Yeah, that's a great section. The sort of labyrinthian nature of that whole building coupled with just the weirdness of the people he's having to interact with. Yeah, that's fantastic. That actually is a good springboard onto a question that I had for Johan to sort of tie this into your own work just real briefly, and we'll talk more about your work in our bonus episode that we do after this. But your book, The Red Handler, is a really fun and very well written deconstruction of the detective novel, and it's clear that there's a I guess passion for that genre and that style that exists in there. I'm curious how you felt about the Lou Bassnight scenes in this book so far. There's more to come, but what we have gotten so far, you know, as someone who's written a detective novel, how do you feel Pynchon came away from all that? Do you think he hit the sort of tone and the style of that
Oh, definitely, and of course, as always, way better than me. I think actually what I thought about when I read it was more my most recent novel, Under the Paving Stones, The Beach, because in that novel there's a couple of fairly long sections involving brutal spy agent guy who's put up. Starts with being a part of Norwegian intelligence and then moving to the US, and he becomes a CIA agent and then ends up also working with the KGB and the Chinese government, and before he also has connections in with the Stasi in the East Germany, etc., etc. And I always wanted to write crime, or even more so like a spy story, espionage thriller thing. But I could never do it, how should I say it, in a serious way or as a straight-out thriller or anything. I don't have the composition, so to say. I had to do it in a quirky way. I think my approach to it was imagining something almost along the lines of like a Wes Anderson espionage thriller where things move on really rapidly, and there's... With Luke Basnett, it's just really, really intriguing how he does it. And again, with Pynchon, how he is able to move from the dime novel boy adventure into this, and then segueing later on into the Western style of writing, and how it just keeps moving back and forth. But as was mentioned also, just with the whole hotel sequence and everything, He's a really fascinating character, and I'm looking forward to seeing what happens next with him. Not sure if that was an answer to anything, but
yeah, absolutely. Is there anything that's pretty much everything I had for Against the Day coverage? Was there anything else, Kate, Luke, Will, that you wanted to bring up or mention regarding this first part of the book?
I don't think so. Usually, I feel like. In past seasons, I've had a bunch of stuff that we haven't talked about, but all of our episodes have been pretty comprehensive.
As we're putting it, yeah.
Yeah, I do think we eventually, even if they weren't put on the page in your notes, I do think we got around to all of the thoughts I had bringing up.
Johan, was there anything else you wanted to bring up about Against the Day so far?
The only thing I think, and maybe not that interesting to anyone, or maybe it is, but I just wanted to say a couple of few words about the Norwegian translation, since I have been reading this in both the Norwegian and English, because usually with all English literature, I'll read it in the original. But with Against the Day, I sort of came from two places. I wanted to make sure that I really not at all, or as much as I could. But also, I wanted, since we in our email exchanges talked about translation, I wanted to be able to say at least something about what I considered to be the qualities of the translation. Mm-hmm. And of course, I cannot speak for the whole book, but from what I read, I can honestly say that I find the translation to be absolutely terrific. To the degree that I'm constantly flabbergasted, not only by Pynchon's sentences, but also by how his twists and turns and play with words, often obscure, or his use of jargon and period-specific phrases, seemingly effortlessly have been translated. And in a couple of instances, if I may be so bold to say so, I actually feel the translation superior to the original. It is a weird thing to say, of course, and I have to admit this only happens twice, and it probably has to do with, of course, my understanding of Norwegian being hopefully better than English, and it of course has to do with the jokes, like for instance the episode we talked about with the pool shooting thing, and there's also another bar brawl with interests on page 63. It's just a couple of words that to me sounds funnier than the English equivalent. But I do have one problem though with the English with the Norwegian translation, and it's the chance of chance, because in Norwegian it's translated to the gust of, and
August, which is a loan word from German, is a rather old way in Norwegian of saying sailor. So the Glade Gaste would then be something like the Jolly Sailors or something. Hmm. And of course, let me be quick to say, come to the translator's defense and say that the novel as a whole way more precisely translated than this single term. And what we're dealing with here is more like translating the name of a movie or something like that. The translator has obviously wanted to keep the alliteration from the Chums of Chance to the Glade Gaste. And I have no better suggestion myself, really, to what he should have translated into. The problem, though, is that you lose everything associated with the word chum, which is a really great English word, I think. And jolly, as the Norwegian sailors may be, they are no chums in this translation. And I should also mention, because in Norway we have Crying of Lot 49, Mason and Dixon, Inherent Vice, Against the Day, and Bleeding Edge are the ones translated, if I'm not mistaken. And there have been a few different translators. For instance, with Mason and Dixon, I feel, at least for the 170 or 200 pages, I read that there's quite a lot of these Anglicisms where the translator hasn't been able to or been bothered to find an Norwegian word that should cover the original set. And that's a little bit off-putting, especially in a book that tries to speak in a very old... But the translations of Inherent Vice and Bleeding Edge were done by this translator slash literary critic called Eben Jordal, and it's absolutely fantastic. He's also the Norwegian translator of David Foster Wallace. And he did one by Volman and a couple of George Saunders books. And also with Wallace, having read pretty much everything about him, I had to read the translations as well, and it's just remarkable work. So if for nothing else, you can rest assured that the Norwegian translations of Pynchon, especially from Against the Day and onwards, are really Norwegian, I think.
That's good to know, because I've always kind of been curious about the translation process, especially when it comes to things like idioms and the sort of, unique little things to each individual language, and how you kind of, turn that into something that the reader in any other language might be able to understand. So I can only imagine it's an incredibly difficult job to do. And it's something that I think is underappreciated in the literary world, is the translation and the work that those translators put into these books. So, I'm glad to know that they were able to tackle such a challenging author and really present it in the way that was intended, and to get that, across to those readers. So that's really good to know.
I mean, it has to be an almost a nightmarish job, because you can't contact Pynchon and ask him, what do you mean with this or anything. I've been fortunate enough to, I think my books, not all of them, but in total, have been translated to around something like 25 or 30 languages, which means that I've been working with a lot of translators from different languages. And my experience is always that if the translator is willing, and if we can elaborate on some level, it's way better for the for everyone. So usually what I do is, and when the first person translates one of my books, I always ask them to send me whatever questions they may have, big or small, and I promise to answer whatever they need to know. And usually also these translators, and I think what most people don't get is that they're not only proficient in the language they're translating from, they also have this great knowledge about the cultural aspects, or all these small things they've been to, in this case Norway, a lot.
and they have to be as good actors as the author or herself, I think. But usually what I do is I answer in writing all these questions, and then when the next translator starts, he or she will get all the questions and answers from first person, and then I just build this document. So the longer you wait until you translate one of my books, the more material you will have. There is bound to be stuff you don't understand, and especially in a 1,000-page novel, no matter how much you know about American culture and Norway is saturated in American culture, but still there has to be stuff that goes over your head. And then there's the errors, of course, just plain out flat out mistakes. But that being said, I'm astounded by the level of the Norwegian translations.
Like, I've been reading a lot more translated fiction, I want to say, like, the past, like, 2 years. And it has come to be something that I've started to read a lot of in sort of my free time. Like, I started reading the new Penguin Proust editions this past year, and the translator of the first volume of Proust had a very lengthy, like, introduction to her translation that evidently, when these editions were first published in the 2010s, mid to late 2010s is when they started coming out, she had to, like, defend herself from critics of sort of what was considered, like, the long-term kind of, or the long-term, like, most respected translation of Proust prior to that. And that was something that really woke me up to just how intense of an art it is. Mm-hmm. You know, like, when I was in seminary, we had an activity where we had to translate a chapter of the Bible. We could just pick any chapter we wanted to translate, but we had to translate it. And that took me like a month to do. But on top of that, I also had 2,000 years of like random scholarship in history to draw upon for something so intensely focused on. Mm-hmm. Whereas, yeah, like I think a lot of modern translators have maybe a more difficult task, you know, in front of them in regards to the fact that there's not as much context that they can really draw upon beyond going to those places or learning about, you know, the two different worlds that you're taking one language from and then transposing it into a different one. It is a monumental thing, and I can't even imagine how long it would take to translate Against the Day from one language to another.
Yeah,
and really, especially with having zero context provided by the author, that's got to be incredibly hard. So it is truly impressive if that translation is that good. It's wild.
Let me just end my thoughts on this with this brief story from a few years ago, which is sort of a good example of how difficult the task of translation is. I was doing this thing at the Sorbonne University in Paris with my French translator, and he was teaching his translation students, or the students in Norwegian in Paris, and we were going to, I don't speak French though, so I was just sitting in on the conversation, and the task for the day was to translate the first page, only the first page of another novel of mine, which also happens to be 1,000 and, how long is Against the Day in, let me see.
Like 1,085.
Yeah, so and my book is 1,086, I think, because I told the guy who was doing the typesetting that I needed to be 1 to 2 pages longer than Against the Day, but it has to be shorter than. Sorry, the joke is completely lost. And it has to. It was supposed to be in the middle of Infinite Jest and Against the Day. Anyway,
sure.
That was
more than 185, but less than 1,311.
Yeah, something like that. They're supposed to translate the first page of this novel called Max Misha and the Tet Offensive, and the first sentence of the book in Norwegian is Dagen Begynner, which in English is something like The Day Begins. After an hour, they were still on the first sentence discussing, like, almost, again, Wes Anderson like a big conundrum of all the different ways you could translate word of the sentence "the day begins," and I just had to leave the room. I never even finished the first page. So that is the problem. There's just so many choices you can make. So if you end up making enough good choice that text feels like it's not translated at all, and if you're lucky enough to be able to read it both in the translated and original, and it feels like reading the same book, and my hat off to translator, because that's a really, really difficult job.
Hey everybody, producer Cody here. Just wanted to jump in and mention that we received an email after we recorded with Johan, and we wanted to include what was included in that email here with you all. Our friend Kenny from Scotland, who, if you listened to the Bleeding Edge episodes, recorded the Pringle Chip Equation song, took it upon himself to do a rendition of the Chums of Chance song on ukulele, and it's really cool. And we wanted to share that with everybody, so that'll be tacked on at the end here just in a minute.
Well, if we don't have anything else regarding Against the Day, we'll go ahead and end it there. So I just want to say thank you, everyone, for listening. It's been a lot of fun to talk about this. It's been a lot of fun to talk about this with Johan. Thank you so much for joining us and talking about this. We are going to kind of keep recording with Johan here for a little while and just kind of have a separate discussion about his work and just kind of other things that come up. So we'll release that as a separate bonus episode sometime in the near future. But for the time being, thanks again so much for listening. We really appreciate it. And we'll see you in part two.
Okay, chums. Time for an itty bitty ditty. Those fellows live in little towns, those who live on farms, and never seem to wander far from smiles and loving arms. They always know just who they are and how their lives will go. And then there's boys like us who say goodbye before hello, for we're the aces of the altitudes, vagabonds of the void. What's a vagabond, Lindsay? When some folks shrink with terror, say we scarcely get annoyed. So let the wind blow off the Beaufort scale, hoo hee, and the nights grow dark as can be. Is a plucky soul who shall neither whine nor ejaculate, for his blood's as red as his mind's as pure as the stripes of his blazer. Immaculate.